Today's show is brought to you in part by our newest partners at the Adelphi Racing Club. Adelphi is a racing club of like-minded people who enjoy racing and the camaraderie of being part of something bigger than themselves, a true community, an interactive experience with real-time access to other partners, trainers, bloodstock advisors, and members of the team. And you're going to get frequent updates as well from multimedia partners such as ourselves over here at In the Money Media. In the upcoming class of prospects, there's this horse, Salivo. We're super excited about this Street Sense filly. And there's also a yet-to-be-named Taprit colt going to be going to the Clement Barn. Salivo's going to be headed to Ray Handel for training. Join the club. Lots of ways to get in touch. AdelphiRacing.com. Holler at Matt@AdelphiRacing.com or social media. On Insta, you're looking at @Adelphi_racing. And on Twitter, it's @AdelphiClub. But probably the best thing is just to go to that website, AdelphiRacing.com. Welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our show for Wednesday, November 10th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatow, back with you from the Brooklyn Bunker once again. No, I'm no longer in California. I'm no longer at the Pacific Coast Grill, no longer at Del Mar Racecourse, but right back here in New York City and joined by a man who doesn't frequent New York City. He's here once in a while. Typically, he's out on the planet Texas. He revisited an old persona this weekend, though. I was remembering when we used to call him Johnny Stacks, the way he was firing away. Speaking, of course, about the People's Champion, Jonathan Kinchin. What's happening, my man?
PTF, I'm over here in your neck of the woods. I'm over here looking out my hotel, looking down on the vessel at Hudson Yards. Have you seen this device, this big machine, this big statue, stairs? Do you know what I'm speaking of?
I actually have no idea what you're talking about. I know they've done a ton of work over there. I know about the whole project, but I don't know specifically about the vessel. What are we dealing with?
I don't know. It's just like this big, like, I don't know. I can't even describe it. Like this big kind of like walking, like statue of art thing in the middle of Hudson Yard. So Google it.
I will. I will. That sounds cool.
You'll know what I speak of.
Yeah, we'll check out the vessel at Hudson Yards. I might be accused of a host fail, or at least for burying the lead, by the fact that I did not introduce you as now two-time second in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, Jonathan Kinchin. Unbelievable stuff, JK. Another big run, 2 years in a row. How are you feeling about your accomplishment at this big tournament with a couple of days hindsight?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've made some cheeky comments about it, right? But in all fairness, like the way that I feel about it is like, you know, it's important to me to be taken serious as a horse player, and people that know me well and people that are, you know, that have known me since I, you know, 2014, 15, they know that like I am an actual horse player, you know, like I'm actually doing this. And I've even like jokingly, arrogantly said that like no one on TV like is like bets like I'm betting, like, you know what I mean? So it's like, don't give me a hard time about, you know, giving a chalky pick four. I'm out here firing with so much efficiency that it might make you sick to your stomach. You know what I mean? And so it's like, I think that when situations like this happen, it makes me feel good. It's not that I'm out here searching for validation, but we're all human. And it is a validating situation to have that success on that big stage. So, it was fun, man. And it's fun. You know, it's fun. It's exciting. We, you know, the Breeders' Cup is fun because we wait all year for those 14 championship races. And it's even more fun when you can have, you know, some success in a contest that I know that most horse players are excited about waiting all year for as well.
And the money doesn't suck either. What'd you walk with?
I think like 367, something like that.
Woo!
I said it like I didn't know for sure. I think, well, it might be a little bit less than that. 350 maybe.
How'd you get all that on the plane? I kid.
Yeah. It's not as hard as you would think.
Any regret at all about second, you know, second at Keeneland, second last year at the BC, second here? Is this getting a little tedious, so the whole Mr. Exacta thing?
No, it feels like that's like... Yes. I mean, it's not tedious, right? Like, I mean, sure. Like I want to win and like, I wanted to win the Keeneland contest because I really love Jim Goodman, respect Jim Goodman and want to have that on my resume that I've won one of his contests. You know, and obviously winning the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge is huge. You know, it's one of those, it's a major, if not the major, in my opinion. You know, the NHC will always have its place, you know, with the Eclipse Awards and you know, and putting yourself next to people like Paul Matisse and Michael Bachok is something that is you know, legacy building as well. But, you know, I do want a Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge win, but I'm not frustrated about it. It's because it's really not in my control. There's not a whole lot I could do. You know, my second choice has won the last two races, and I ended up with $95,000 and got second. So I can't really complain, because what I wanted kind of I did what I needed to do to the best of my ability. You know, maybe there was something in hindsight I could have done a little bit different earlier, but it's like, you know, it's a game of inches. And if you start trying to add up all those inches, you'll drive yourself crazy. I just kind of look at the big picture.
I think that's wise. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about strategy in the contest, but you mentioned Jim Goodman. There's a rumor that you have actually been struck from his holiday card list, JK, because apparently on national television last night, you, a man so connected with the horse racing industry, which of course in this country, the seat of which is in Lexington, Kentucky, apparently behind the bench at Madison Square Garden, wearing a Duke sweatshirt? What the hell, man?
I know. My Twitter was blowing up last night and my cell phone. All right, so here's what happened. Okay. My girlfriend and her family are huge Duke fans. And so this was always part of the trip that we were going to go to the Duke game after the Breeders' Cup, blah, 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 blah. And her father, like, got the tickets. And we were in, like, a good spot, like, you know, 9th, 10th row or whatever it might be. And you know, they're Saratoga people. They were friendly with these fellows that helped with security there. And when the game switched from Kansas and Michigan State to Duke and Kentucky, they moved us down to those seats right behind the bench. Now, I don't give a dang. Do I like the Kentucky Wildcats? I do. I've probably lost more money on the Kentucky Wildcats playing basketball than most people, because I'm a huge fan of their program. I like Cal. I like everything about it. And am I a Duke hater, Duke fan? I like Duke. I could care less, right? They got me a hoodie.
Let's face it, JK. You like whichever team you bet on. Whichever team covers the spread is the team.
That is true, unless it's Texas playing. And they got me the hoodie, so I don't care. I'll wear the hoodie. I'm running out of clothes anyways on this long trip. So it just so happened that I had a Duke hoodie on down. And I mean, I got messages from everyone. And some death threats, jokingly. People saying they're canceling their Old Smoke orders. Matt Jones tweeted, which he's got like 250,000 followers of rabid Kentucky fans. And he's tweeted, if that's UT Big Hair behind the UK bench with a Duke hoodie on, he's got some explaining to do. that got my Twitter going a little bit too. So, yeah, it was fun. It was a good game. They're both teams are pretty good.
Oh, that's funny. Do you think you can show your face in Lexington again at this point?
I have until next April, so they'll probably forget my name.
Time heals all wounds, after all. You mentioned about tournament strategy and how you approached it, and for the second year in a row being able to get there. I think last year it was a spreadier turf into your second choice in the Classic. This time around, you were tighter, 2x2. But if I'm remembering right, you're definitely your second choice in each race. Getting there, what was the biggest difference overall in terms of your strategy from last year to this year? What are the biggest differences in how it all played out when you reflect on last year's experience versus this year's?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically the same. I would say that, you know, the strategy is the same, which I'll kind of state as best I can. And then the difference, I would think, is basically, and I'll work backwards, is the difference is that going into the Classic last year, I had more money to cover more scenarios to kind of get where I wanted to get. This year, I didn't have as much, so I had to be a little bit more direct, but that was fine because that was my opinion. My opinion was that Yabir or Tarnawa were going to win, and my opinion was that Brad Cox was going to win. I mean, I joked about it twice or three or four times leading up to the Breeders' Cup. So, and you know, when I put the money in to see where it would kind of put me, it was basically the same as last year. Now, Going back,
say that, you mean if your top pick had come in, you would have got you to what you had.
Oh yeah. Well, if my top pick, if it would have come top pick. So last year, if Improbable would have won, because Tarnal was my top pick, if Improbable would have won, I would have, my ending bankroll would have been 330.
Oof.
Right. And we've talked about this. Improbable is arguably best. And then this year I had a $20,000 double with Tarnawa and Essential Quality. Those are my two top picks. I don't know what that would have paid. Someone could do the math on it, I'm sure, and I could probably look it up while we're talking. The strategy was pretty simple. My strategy in these contests, especially the big one, the BCBC, is, you know, and I don't care if I give it away, I am not interested in the minimums. I play the minimums because I have to play the minimums. And every time I bet a minimum, it's easy. It's either for a kind of a big pop or a 100% bankroll preservation. And then I find opinions that I feel like I can lock up, tie up, and then I use my money as ammunition and I bet my money on those situations. It's very simple what I did. I tried to beat Corniche on Friday. That didn't work out. I woke up with $7,000 or $3,500 on Saturday morning. I went all in on Lone Rock.
Had $3,500 on one entry left after day.
No, $3,500 on two.
Okay,
$7,000 total. I went all in on Lone Rock, and then into doubles with Going Global and Zofel. If Zofel would have won, I would have got to $30,000. That was my top choice. But Going Global won, I got to 13. I bet again. It basically just kind of broke even. And then I went all, and then I singled Life Is Good with doubles and caught Aloha West. Then I caught the Japanese horse. That didn't even make as much money as I hoped it would make. And then that's when it started to get good, where I hit a double into Space Blues for like 38,000, 35,000, and then I bet the whole 35,000 going into those late doubles.
How did you end up weighting your money in the sprint? Because you were on record, and this may well have been. I mean, I think you were dead on. You know, you had expressed some skepticism about the post for Jackie's Warrior. I'm not saying that's the only thing that went wrong there, but it was the trip you feared for him. And I believe you, like me, thought that the main threat was Aloha West. How was your money allocated percentage wise in the sprint?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember I'm trying to remember because look, the Aloha West photo was huge for me, but I'm trying to remember if it was because of a double or if it was because of the pick six. I used in that race, I used Aloha West, Following Sea, Jackie's Warrior, CZ Rocket a little bit, and Lexitonian. I used all of them. And I used Aloha West basically kind of true to what his odds were. Pressed Jackie's Warrior. Honestly, I pressed Jackie's Warrior a little bit. It's funny, like, you know, that one guy said that one comment about how all my top picks basically lost and I still got second. When the bets come out, if you look at it, you'll see that most of my money was through my top picks.
Yeah. And there were a few different tweets. I want to specify that I don't think you know. Michael Domable was complimenting you. And then some other people took it in a left direction.
Some guy said it's a bad look. Okay. Come on. Okay. Yeah.
That was not the definitive picks video. That was the head to head gimmick. You know what I mean?
Space Blues was great.
I just want to make sure that Michael Domable doesn't get crossed off your holiday card.
Of course not. Space Blues was great. If Smooth Like Straight would have won, I still would have had money. I would have got money back. I was alive to Smooth Like Straight for like 15,000, maybe not nearly as much as I was obviously to Space Blues. Hit Space Blues, went all in again. And here we go. So, and it's, you know, it's funny because like we start doing these videos like the week before, basically we start talking about these races the week before.
Sure.
And we kind of get our feet put to the fire. Friday night I ran into a prominent trainer who told me that Latruska just didn't like look like very like light and just didn't look the same and didn't look like the horse that they had seen. Well, I'm not going to be like, oh, well, I'm going to bet Latruska just because I told everyone else I was going to bet Latruska on Wednesday.
Right.
And I think I just tried to get I don't think I bet very much in that race. I think maybe I bet just the minimum trying to beat Latruska. I had to bet a minimum.
That was a hell of a race for most people, right? I'm a wise guy with Dunbar Road and getting nipped. I know that cost a lot of people the pick six. Did that cost you the pick six?
It did. Still, the consoles were good though.
But your fives come back.
I think they came back. I want to say, I could be wrong. I want to say $800.
Okay.
I want to say $800. So I got back. I doubled, you know?
So not only are you Mr. Exacta when it comes to the Breeders' Cup, you're also Mr. 5 of 6.
Yeah. 5 of 6, that booger last year too, for a little bit. So, yeah, man, what a nasty photo that was. So,
oh man, that would have been huge for me. I know that much. But I tell you what, for BCBC, who knows? Because I know there were some wise guys on Dunbar Road there, including Mr.
Foreman.
He might have been there right at the end with you in the BCBC. And you know, the whole decision tree changes from there. So it's hard to figure out too much exactly how it all would have gone down. But it was a pretty crazy. Pretty crazy 2 days of betting. Elsewhere on the network, we're going to cover the debacle of Friday, but I suppose that is a topic we should at least chime in on quickly. I wrote a little piece about it on my live blog I was doing for attheraces.com. I mean, one of the more shameful incidents in the history of our mutual wagering, but we can say that again. I might save some of my thoughts because I am going to try to get Jay Privman on to do another show later in the week about it. But why don't you opine for a second about how that made you feel as a horse player?
Well, here's the base level of it, right? It was frustrating. I had some friends that had never been to the Breeders' Cup before. And, you know, we obviously suck in a lot of people during the Breeders' Cup to watch. And it's really hard to explain to someone how they're going to play this gambling game, and that horse just won, but it doesn't really count. You know, so that part is tricky. I think racing as a whole should do better to try to prevent stuff like that. I understand what they were trying to do with that rule, but the problem is that if someone's going to get, and this was not the word I used when I described it Friday night, if someone's going to get screwed, let's not worry about screwing the person who inadvertently canceled their ticket. Let's worry about the person who had zero choice of changing anything at that point. So someone's going to lose. Let's not punish the person who's alive in pick sixes and pick fives. Let's go ahead. If someone's going to get punished, let's punish the person who ran to the window and canceled their $25 win play show bet. Like, to me, the game should feel like, look at it that way, because I understand what happened. There was an inadvertent scratch. And so because if there's an inadvertent scratch, you then now have the horse has to stay scratched. And I'm assuming because, like, you know, well, you can't, you know, people are canceling it, but like, to me, like, punish
the person. It would have been chaos to put the horse back in the betting, but honestly, reflecting on it after this happened, I would rather have I don't know how you do it with TV and everything, but I mean, what if you could put the horse back in the betting and delay it 5 minutes and blast it from the universe?
Really, chaos. I don't think it'd be chaos.
I mean, it would be bad. Somebody would get hosed, but I think you're right. Not to the degree that actually
not this hosed. And I'm very friendly with Danny Hargargan, and so I'm not sure. But then it's like if you're the type of person who has singled a Charlie Appleby Godolphin runner, you probably don't have or need Danny Gargan off of Monmouth win.
At that price.
No, you probably just don't need Danny Gargan off of Monmouth win. Like, that's probably not the type of player you are.
Right.
And so to not only lose your top choice in your single or your press or your use, now you're getting moved over to the post-time favorite.
horse that you would never use in this case.
Yeah,
I agree.
No situation. I mean, and not that that makes any difference if it would have been, you know, if Aiden would have gone off favorite. I'm just saying it just adds to the kind of crappiness of the whole situation, I would imagine, for most
players. How galling it all is. And, you know, we'll get into the CHRB element. I mean, I'd like to reiterate my idea that I don't see the Breeders' Cup as to blame as much. And I don't even see the guy who made the mistake as much to blame as the convoluted CHRB process that doesn't allow for this to go through a central person and a confirmation process. It's like, you know, how many things do you do online? Are you sure you want to go to the next screen? Like, and we don't have that for scratches at the gate at the Breeders' Cup. But I will say this, and you know, I'm going to, you know, I don't mean this to be blasting or anything, and I'll reach out privately to our friends over there at the Breeders' Cup. But I do think it did make me think that somebody dedicated to looking at the wagering. I don't, you know, remember the role that Ken Kirchner used to have at the BC? I'm not sure if he was ever replaced. And it feels like having somebody specifically in that role or a role like that to look at some of these CHRB processes, you know, they're essentially business partners in this thing. If there could be a way for Breeders' Cup to spend a little more scrutiny trying to troubleshoot and look for holes and possible, you know, landmines, that to me would be a very smart idea. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's always something that is it could be beneficial. You know, we have vets that are overseeing the welfare. We have you know, there's safety. There's track. There's, you know, there's hospitality, there's all these other things. And I think that wagering being a huge part of it, you know, they did a great job. I thought hiring Jim Goodman to kind of be the kind of point guy when it comes to the contest situation. And maybe even taking that a step further is something they should consider.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the beyond the contest, just looking at the whole paramutual world there. And yeah, Jim does a great job. And, you know, it's good that Tim Schramm, in terms of like putting the contest together and getting everybody what they need. I mean, he's in a fantastic role. And I think he and Jim make a great team, along with Chris Barr and John Reynolds and the rest of the team there. It's the BCBC part of it, I feel pretty good about. But I think they're, you know, the idea that even more could be done to get creative and protect players when it comes to wagering, it's something to look at. And again, this isn't me just spouting off. I'll put my money where my mouth is, and I'm happy to, as you've done in the past too, JK, consult for free to help improve all these processes.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it's the wagering part of this game is very important, and there's a lot of people in lots of positions of power in the game that don't fully understand the betting portion of it, and that's okay. They understand their portions of it really well. Or maybe it's not okay. I'm not casting stones at people who, at every, you know, it's just I do think that there is a place in which having someone who is a little bit more adept at the wagering part of it in some of these positions of power, or at least with access to people with these positions of power, is a useful thing. You know, it's a useful thing. It's one of the things I know Tony Alavato comes from a betting background. He asks the right questions. He has Dave O'Rourke thinking about the right things, whether you agree or you disagree, but getting the pick six back to a dollar, you know, that's when you have management that understands it. Doing the CRW stuff that they've done at NYRA, you know, and I'm obviously tooting the NYRA horn because I'm close to that situation. But even like, you know, I think Aiden Butler gets it too, you know, from a betting standpoint. And this, you know, I think Stronach's probably, in my opinion, and I'm not casting stones, is a little bit further behind in some of their horse player decisions, but that's because they have previous relationships I think they're trying to work through and whatever. So it's like, I think it's important to have someone and have these people that are making decisions that are a little bit more wagerer friendly.
I'd put it like this. It's, you know, not everybody in high levels in racing companies is going to be come from a horse playing background, and that's fine. But it's a question of like, know what you know and know what you don't know. And the things that you don't know, you rely on people who do. Right. I mean, it's pretty simple, actually. I think the Breeders' Cup generally fall into that category, but I wouldn't mind seeing more of it, I guess is all I'm saying.
It's just tough for the Breeders' Cup too, man. Like, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses, but it's tough. Like, they literally operate for 2 days a year. So it's like they don't have a lot of trial and error to make sure that they catch and create systems that prevent bad things from happening. And then when a situation like this jumps out and bites you, you know, you're in a different jurisdiction with different rules about this, that, and the other, and you got horses circling, and you got people on walkie talkies yelling and carrying on, and here's what we have to do. You know, it's hard.
Well, it's hard because they run it, but they don't run it. You know, I think it's a little fraud, and we've seen this before with the CHRB in particular. But anyway, we'll put a pin in that. We'll save some of that for when I'm going to yap with Jay. Hopefully, a little bit later in the week. I haven't confirmed that with him, but hopefully, we can get that on the calendar. He won't be too nuts to join us. Let's just spend a few minutes. We've got about 5 minutes left here, JK. I wouldn't mind just talking about some of your favorite performances on the track. Who really impressed you?
I love it. We'll start from the top and work backwards. I thought Nick's Go was outstanding. He basically turned into the horse that you know, and had the performance I thought he would. And look, see, the thing about it is there's people that I'm interested to see what Paul and Nick say, because I've kind of heard Paul's take a little bit. And I think most are going to be a little, and some are going to be annoyed that Nick's Go got that loose lead like that. But let me tell you, if I owned or trained Medina Spirit, if I owned or trained Hot Rod Charlie, or if I owned or trained Art Collector, I'm going to hope this horse doesn't want to go a mile and a quarter. There's no way in hell I'm hooking him, because I know he's going to go, and I know he's going to cruise. So I'm not going to hook him. I'm going to hope he comes back to me. I'm going to hope I sit off of him and he comes back to me. I'm not, you know, this idea that Johnny V and Flavian Pratt and Mike Smith are somehow supposed to do the dirty work so people who bet on Essential Quality and Max Player can get a pace to close into. I just don't see the world that way. So I thought Nick's Go was brilliant, and I thought that, you know, when you have, maybe loaded gun's not the right way. If you're a professionally trained fighter, you're not going to get tested at a bar when people are drinking, carrying on, wanting to look for a fight. They're not coming over and testing you. And I feel that that's how they treat Nick's Go. He's a professionally trained fighter on the front end. Why the hell do you want to get in the ring with him?
I just thought there were so many opportunities. I thought one of them would try him. I really did. I mean, I didn't know Medina Spirit could settle the way that he did. So good training, good riding as far as that goes. Because I would agree, I am of the mind if Medina Spirit was the one to get all up in there, that he would have run last. I'm on record as saying that. I still believe it's true. But I would have figured that, you know, I mean, I guess Art Collector, I got to go back and watch Mike Smith's hands. I don't think, it did seem like he was content to sit off. He didn't really try him. I figure his chance would have been better to win. And even Hot Rod Charlie, I thought his chance would have been better to win. So I would have thought that somebody would have gone and was a little disappointed that they didn't. I mean, I won't lie. I mean, Nick's Go was impressive. I mean, the clock on time for me runs a 133. They did downgrade him a point to a 132 final. There was a blue fraction in there, and critically, that blue fraction being the mile for a horse that there were some questions about getting the mile and a quarter. But I mean, Nick's Go went out there. He made no mistake. That was one of the scenarios that made sense for me in the race. I just wanted it to be more of a horse race. That's all.
No, I get it. And I'll speed round you here, PTF, before you run. Yabir, I watch his race at the Jockey Club Derby. I could actually tell that he was moving well. And I don't have that club in my bag, but like that's he's just an interesting looking mover. And that was one of the reasons that I used a little bit. I would have never had the Japanese horse or the distaff. Dunbar Road did run really well. Malathot looked loaded. Watch the NBC on YouTube. I thought for sure Malathot was going to win. When I rewatched the race, I was like, Jesus, she's loaded. And she just never really picked up when the running started. Jackie's Warrior, I think, you know, deserves to be, I think, to still be the sprinter of the year with the performances that horse had. He was outstanding. He just, you know, it was a tough post down in there on the inside when you have all that speed to your outside. Del Mar, one of the things I'm glad that I, you know, watching Del Mar and doing the expert picks for Twin Spires for Del Mar and having to look at it a lot and like learning that inside draws do well in turf races, horses that can get inside trips. That was one of the reasons I had the confidence to lean on Space Blues the way that I did. I just felt like that horse is going to get a perfect trip in there covered up. Life Is Good was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I did a little, I had a little cheat. I did there, Pete. I love the horse, and I thought he was vulnerable to a certain extent at a short price, but I still thought he was, you know, likely the most likely winner on the card. And so I messaged Baffert and said, what do you think of Life is Good? Cause you know, it's like his old girlfriend, you know? So you know that he's been watching every morning, waiting for the horse to do something and be like, yeah, see, told you your new boyfriend's fat, you know? And I was waiting for him to give me any sign of negativity. And he said his response was cinch. And then I was like, all right. So I pulled the trigger to go all in, and he was absolutely
that's
right.
That's funny.
About that.
That's some good inside baseball there. Oh, that's great stuff. We got to give Loves Only You a call. What a story. Japan getting two winners. This should redound to the benefit of racing internationally, I would think. So, I mean, I was happy about that. And also, you know, I think I did have Love the Irish Filly was my top pick in the race, but I mean, everywhere I was saying it's one of those two to the hoop. And hey, almost ended up not being the case, but that late surge under Kawada gets the job done for Love's Only You. And I think that's a Breeders' Cup memory we'll be talking about for a long time.
And the other thing, I'm going to spend some time today at some point when I just, you know, sit down and have an adult beverage with my friend who lives in Brooklyn. I got to figure out why Golden Pal ran so slow at Keeneland and why that figure was so slow and why he ran so well in the Breeders' Cup. I don't know if it was firm ground. I just want to study that, because that's, to me, there's something there that I want to make sure that I understand.
And we'll close it out by saying, after a brutal end of Friday, how great was it in race four, first Breeders' Cup race on Saturday, getting to see Mike McCarthy in the winner's circle. What a run from CC. Fascinatingly, in a race where the fractions were coded blue to the half and the 6 furlongs on time from US. I would not have guessed that, but CC, very good, gets her signature win. JK, that's all the time we got, unless you have a quick closing thought.
Yeah, give that guy 200 horses. And tell me he doesn't make the same type of noise that Bob Baffert, Todd Pletcher, Chad Brown, and Brad Cox do. Michael McCarthy does a phenomenal job. He always shows up on these big stages, and his horses run well.
I wonder if he'd take that offer, if he's happy with 50 that he can touch them all every day. I don't know. We'll have to ask. He's due for a visit back on the show, but couldn't agree more. One of the most underrated in the game. All right, we are ready now for our next guest.
Right after this.
A quick word from our sponsors, Mill Ridge. So happy to be working with our friends at Mill Ridge, 36 Grade 1 winners since 2000, raising and selling racehorses at Mill Ridge. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, Mill Ridge Farm has a rich history of raising and selling some of the best thoroughbred racehorses in the world. This is a place where, if you're in the industry, you probably already know about. They should definitely be on your mind, especially with their stallion, Oscar Performance, off to a very promising start. And if you're a racing fan, this is a beautiful place to visit. If you're in the Lexington area, go to millridge.com to learn more. Check it out, millridge.com. Next up on the show, very proud to introduce my friend, the OG In the Money Plus subscriber, collaborator on a book that will still one day see the light of day, called Easy Game. He is the 2021 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge champion, Matt Miller. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. As a longtime friend of yours, it's a little surreal to believe that I'm now actually on the show that I've listened to, but it's a real honor. Thanks.
Well, let's talk about your mental state, first of all. You still buzzing? What are you thinking in your heart, reflecting on this major victory a few hours now after it's happened?
Yeah, I mean, definitely still buzzing. I got to say, I'm a little bit more overwhelmed by the support I've gotten from family and friends. Most of these people don't pay much attention to horse racing or my endless stories about horse racing. And so the fact that they're volunteering to listen to this and to talk about it is pretty special to me and means an awful lot.
You said you were trying to explain to people in your circle the collegial atmosphere between tournament players. It sounded like an outsider would have thought it would be a little bit more cutthroat, you know, maybe Jonathan being upset that somebody but him had won instead of taking the time to send out a tweet about how excited he was for you at the same time. How do you try to describe that
idea, that concept of that contest players compete but also root for each other. Can you get that message across to people in the outside world?
Very easily. I got to tell you, I don't even look at the leaderboard until maybe the last couple races. And we'll get into this, but I have a strategy that starts from the end. And I want to get to $125,000. I think that's what it usually takes to win. And so I don't really care what other people are doing in the interim as long as they haven't moved that bar at all. And so as I look at the leaderboard, all I'm focused on, to be honest, is my bankroll, taking advantage of the opportunities that I think are best to grow my bankroll. And really, I try very hard not to I don't sit in the contest room if I can help it. It makes me a little crazy listening to people yelling for things that I don't have. I try really to do my own thing. And if you take that view, look, if I'm not going to win, I've got a list of people that I'd love to see win this thing. And I think I'm on some of their lists too. And so realistically, you don't think you're going to win this. And so it's easy to root for your friends. You don't really look at them as threats to you anyway, because you're more of a threat to yourself than they are. And so, you know, I'm going to call out a couple people by name, you know, champion Brad Anderson from a couple of years ago. You know, we're best buds when it comes to this stuff. And so we go to this together and talk the whole time. We've got a buddy, a common buddy in Joe Rumfalo. He sat with us in 19 when Brad won. He sat with us again this time. People like yourself, it's so collegial. It's so nice. But right, I guess if me and Brad were both alive to different horses in the last race, I am firmly rooting against him. And that is that. But other than that, honestly, you just want it to go to someone that you know, that you like, that you feel is a good, you know, representative of the sport or whatever. And yeah, it's been absolutely terrific.
We've had an incredible run of champions: Chuck Grubbs, Brad Anderson, Marshall Graham, yourself. I hope that was a dead run and I didn't leave out somebody who deserved a shout out there. But I do want to harken back to 2019 for a minute. And I was wondering if there was any element of FOMO for you back in 2019. See Brad getting the victory with a strategy that he was on record as saying you helped design. And then, you know, that your emotions between then and then now, to be able to get that yourself and to be able to see that trophy sitting up on your mantelpiece, what does that mean to you as a player?
It's really not believable. You don't think you're going to win this. You don't even think someone in your circle is going to win this. And so for that to happen within my circle a couple times in 3 years is crazy. And, you know, it's funny. You did an interview of Brad at the end of that event. I popped in for the last 5 seconds and gave a thumbs up. And I think, you know, the look on my face was sincere. I was thrilled for the guy. But yes, in terms of FOMO or whatever, of course, you know, having that trophy on your own mantle, having done it yourself, it's a very different feeling and really special. I have such regard for this event, for the competitors. You know, ask someone walking down the street what they'd like to win. And someone might say, I'd want to be a Jeopardy champion. Someone might want to win the World Series of Poker. I couldn't get BCBC out of my mouth fast enough. And so, I mean, it's really an unbelievable feeling.
What's special about the BCBC that makes you put it up there over bracelets and national fame and all the things that would come with those other accolades you mentioned?
Well, I'm on your podcast, so I think I've got national fame taken care of.
Among a very sick group of people, yes. I kid, of course.
Look, the Breeders' Cup is the big event of the year. It's the Olympics of horse racing, as everybody says. I remember from the movie Let It Ride, as Terry Garr says, I don't understand why you can't just watch the horses run around without betting, and everyone in the Turf Club laughed. It's actually the one time of year that I can do that. I can just watch them run around in a circle and be really happy watching. And so the event itself is so spectacular. I'm going to digress for a second, and I'm going to call out Tim Schramm and Jim Goodman and the rest of that staff. These guys put on a top-notch event. It's great seating. It's great camaraderie, as we've talked about. okay, the food's just kind of okay, but it's nice to have food and drink. But the setting is unbelievable. And, you know, it's, look, it's also a time, if I'm being honest, I don't bet like this during normal times. You know, I'm an Arlington guy, or I was an Arlington guy, and we can get to that later. But I don't bet like this when I go to the racetrack. So it's kind of the one time a year where you can truly justify doing this. You know, your price of admission is your price of admission to a game. Pete, you and I have talked about Monopoly money before, and I fully believe that when you put down your money or you win your way in, you've won your way into a different type of Monopoly game. And it is highly unproductive to be thinking about these as dollars as opposed to points. And yet I admit there is an insane thrill to a $33,000 win bet on a horse that isn't even the favorite. I mean, there's a few things as I look back that I'm a little bit in disbelief. Knowing my propensity for favorites, it's tough to believe I didn't cave. I had a $33,000 bankroll, which I thought might possibly be good enough if I switched to essential quality. I kind of quickly talked myself out of that as I reminded myself of the $125,000 target. Turns out, actually, if I had played essential quality, it would have been really close if he had won potentially. Maybe JK would have had a lot more than me. I don't know, but
he would have.
Yeah. And so sticking with the horse that you planned to bet for a couple weeks, when you had the luxury of thinking it was good enough to win the tournament for you, made it very easy. But don't get me wrong, I've never made a bet that big in my life. And unless I find myself in this position again somehow someday, I don't expect that to ever happen again. You can kind of justify it as being in the middle of a game, and that's the game that you're playing. So yeah, it's just a completely thrilling time. And even before the last race, and we'll get to it, but the big play before that was 24 grand to win on Life is Good. I don't bet 3 to 5 shots to win normally, and I certainly don't bet $24,000 normally. But again, if you're in the game, you have to play the game, and it's a thrill. So for so many reasons, this event is the one. It's also for me, it's the one with the most prestige. I have no disrespect for the NHC, but I'll just say this about myself. I consider myself to be a B-minus handicapper. And people kind of laugh when I say that, because especially my friends at home all think I'm pretty good at this stuff. But I know what A and A plus handicappers sound like. You got a bunch of them working for you, by the way. and I'm not one of those. What I am is good with numbers and odds and strategy and that kind of stuff. And so I'm going to make this real awkward right now and just say, look, I don't get my horse racing news. I don't get my horse racing opinions from anywhere else besides your podcast and your network. And while obviously there isn't a single person working for you that made this string of picks, what you put out has been extremely helpful in informing my picks. So at the end of the day, everyone has to go their own way. But it's getting that kind of info from you guys that has been just tremendous. And so especially your shows on tournament strategy and, you know, those that have top-heavy prize structures versus flat. I've listened to every word. I can't say that every word was news or learning to me, but some of it has just been good reinforcement. And I think people are crazy to think that they go off and do these things all by themselves, figuring it out all by themselves. I'm very quick to point to in the money. Even Brad and Joe sitting at the table, they're just good for a reality check. So the social element to this is important to some degree. You know, you still have to make up your own mind, but saying to someone, am I crazy that this looks like this? It helps. So,
well, flattery will get you everywhere around here. So we thank you very much for that. We'll send you some In the Money Media swag if you don't already have it. You know, any reflected glory we could take from one of our people, one of our family really winning. I mean, to have essentially an In the Money family from day one exactas 2 years in a row, like, you have no idea how proud that makes me, and I appreciate the kind words. And Brad was extremely generous in his praise for his win 3 years ago. You know, I mean, hey, you guys, it's whatever little way we can help, we'll take whatever credit we can. But at the end of the day, of course, you're the man in the arena putting down this money and making these bets and devising these strategies. And I do want to talk more specifically about strategy, but you've mentioned luck a couple of times. And for me, I just want to ask you to be honest with me and tell me if this isn't really more of a case of the old line. I think it's Branch Rickey. The harder I work, the luckier I get. Or do you really believe luck plays an outsized role? Tell me.
Luck plays a huge role. It just does. Let me tell you what I did, and then you can decide for yourself what part of that was luck and what wasn't. $33,000 to win at the end on Knicks Go was the plan all along. And so I don't really think much of that was luck. You know, maybe it was lucky that Medina Spirit didn't get out lightning fast. Maybe, or maybe it wasn't. JV looked like he had a pretty good hold on the horse.
Oh, yeah. That was a conscious rating, 100%.
Yeah. And so was I lucky that, you know, I don't know. I'm lucky that Knicks Go broke well. It could have been essential quality brushing him, sending him back a length. I mean, so of course there's luck within the context of the race. The bet that got me to that was an all-in win bet on Life is Good, 3 to 5, actually 0.65, and don't laugh because the 0.05 at that volume makes a big difference.
Sure.
It sent me from $24,000 to $40,000. Here's the crazy part. As I strategized in the morning about what to do with my $25,000 bankroll, you know, look, I knew I was going to be dangerous to some degree because I'm willing to play the game. And so someone with $25,000 of ammo it can be dangerous if they know what they're doing. I don't think anyone would have predicted what I would have done on the day. But honestly, all I wanted was to get into the mid-30s so that I could fire it at Knicks Go. And so when I saw an opportunity early in the card to play what felt like one of the locks of the century, I took it. Life is Good ran like that. I mean, here's the lucky part. I had similar feelings about Jackie's Warrior. And if the ordering of the races was different, I absolutely would have busted out. The only chance I might not have is if the horse really was 2 to 5. I might have thought I can get better than that on Life is Good. So I'm not totally sure if I would have busted out. But again, it's race order. I mean, that, and if you don't want to call that luck, I don't think you're being very realistic.
No, you're making a point. I still think, and the Rickey quote, by the way, is luck is the residue of design. The harder I work, the luckier I get is a Sam Goldwyn quote, who might also be the William Goldman is my other favorite quote that I use all the time when talking about typically jockeys, trainers, people who work in the barns, giving their opinions on their horses. And then the exact opposite happens, which is nobody knows nothing. Another one of my favorites. But, you know, I do think you're right. I mean, luck, there's a fair amount of randomness. But, I mean, to come up with this surgical strategy and execute it to the letter, there's something more than luck involved there. Tell us how you built the bankroll. You're doing a great job here going backwards. It sounds like as soon as you had that 35, you knew you were going to hang fire, get your minimums out of the way, whatever, but basically keep it till the classic. It sounds like in the classic, if the prices were reversed on Knicks Go was the horse you wanted to get alive to, but if he'd been 8 to 5 and essential quality 3 to 1, I'm hearing that you probably would have spun 8 to 5 Knicks Go for essential quality. Is that right?
I would have, yes. And if I had a lower bankroll, again, you can take this however way you want. If I had a tiny bankroll and I had enough for a single exacta, this is the one I would have hit. Not, and by the way, not for the right reason. My view of the race.
When you say this, you mean Medina in second?
Yes. My view of the race was that Medina was not going to go on a suicide mission. I just did not think that's what a responsible horse owner would ask a trainer and jockey to do. And so my sense was that Knicks Go was going to have the lead. Medina was going to be sitting behind him, and they would go 1-2 all the way around. And so it's funny, if I had a $5,000 bankroll, I don't know what the thing paid, but I would have had a $5,000 straight exacta in all likelihood.
Oh, that's funny.
And you can say how smart that is, and yet I was completely wrong in the way the race shaped up. I didn't predict Medina Spirit to run the way it did. And so, you know, anyone that wants to just sit there taking credit for being so smart about all this, look, there's an element of that, but luck plays a huge role. Let me get back to Friday. I mean, that's even more ridiculous. So my strategy in these tournaments, well, in this tournament, these $600 minimums bleed you hard in the beginning. It's an appreciable percentage of your bankroll. And, you know, I have a view of what to do with those $600 minimums. I kind of, you know, bump along playing $600 minimums. By the way, 600 bucks is more than I typically play, you know, when I'm making, you know, small bets. You know, that's still a very large unit for me. But I played the strategy of playing a bunch of rolling daily doubles in races that I don't like, just kind of hoping to hit the first half of the double, which will allow me to spread a little bit in the next. And so I did this for a while. You know, regret number one on this tournament, I should have bet Echo Zulu harder. I only did a couple of $600 minimums on my two entries. And as I look back, that's probably a horse I should have been more confident in. But with two $600 doubles rolling into the next race, I hated that next race, and I spread even a little further. I happened to catch Pizza Bianca. I didn't hit it in the second half of the double. I hit it in the first half of a new double. The good news was the horse in the second half of that double was one of those few horses I actually liked and had an opinion about. And so with a $600 double of my fourth choice in the race, Pizza Bianca, a $600 double into Corniche, I think, paid somewhere in the range of 18,000 bucks. I mean, I still can't really understand how. I don't play in these units enough to be comfortable with these numbers that way. But okay, I mean, I guess if you ran the win parlay, I'd say the double paid a little more than it should have. But
definitely.
But all of a sudden, 18,000 bucks on an entry that already had six on it. Yeah, I mean, now you're talking about something, because those $600 minimums don't sting as much anymore.
Right.
And so, look, I think it was a good strategy playing these doubles, but I'm not going to take tremendous pride in picking Pizza Bianca. It was my fourth selection. And I got to tell you, even having, I think I had five horses in that race, I still didn't feel good about it. I mean, this, you know, I'm familiar with the concept of dutching and whatnot. I didn't feel I was doing anything even close to that. There were plenty of horses I would have rather, you know, had the ability to include, but I didn't want to dilute myself further. So that's how I ended up with an $18,000 score on day one. And so if we can go back and put it together, I mean, it sounds almost ridiculous that this was a $600 double with Pizza Bianca into Corniche at 7-5. I sat around patiently, losing $600 a pop for a little while, had the guts to put 24 grand down on what looked like a lock. And then I had the patience to just sit and wait for the end. It made no sense to me to bleed my own bankroll more than I had to, knowing that the entire goal was to bet Knicks go in the Classic with something in the 30s. So, you know, honestly, of the things that I did that were impressive, I would rank perhaps most impressive was the patience to watch these amazing races. I had all these great opinions, I thought, about what was going to happen, but none of them were super strong. And this is why I enjoy the Breeders' Cup so much, is that you can just sit there and skip a race and not feel like you're missing out. You know, it's strategic to skip the race. It's not that you're afraid. It's not that you're whatever. It's just contrary to your strategy. So I think the theme that you're hearing from me over and over is you need a strategy. And until you have reason, hard reason in front of you to change that strategy, don't.
This is great stuff, Matt. This is a masterclass, and I just took some notes, and I'm just going to sum it up. And I think this basically gets to the essence of what we're talking about. Three things I'm hearing from you. If you don't treat it like Monopoly money, you're taking a knife to a gunfight. That would be the first thing I'd say.
Yep.
Work backwards and have a plan that's going to come down to the classic 9 times out of 10. So know what you want to do in there. And then make the rest of your play surgical. No unnecessary bets, because between the minimums bleeding you and the takeout bleeding you, you're just giving away bullets that you're going to want to be able to fire at the end. And I think your strategy basically boils down to those three things. Am I encapsulating it well?
Absolutely. And they're going to publish these plays, and you're going to see my plays being 95% consistent with what I just said. There were a couple of times I just couldn't help it. And I think I bet a little bit more than the $600 minimum. Not much more, but a little bit more. There was also, so my bankroll going into the penultimate race of the contest was somewhere in the range, I'm going to be close with this, maybe 38, 39. There was a horse in the turf. I know you liked it. I know Drew Cotney liked it, a good friend of mine as well that's over there. And I figured I was getting a tremendous opportunity with that horse to perhaps get the luxury of having a live double going into the last race, which would have allowed me to pick a second horse in that race. And so as I looked at the double probables, Walton Street was paying gigantic into Nick's Go. I made a sizable double that would have paid me my targeted amount. And so if Walton Street had somehow won that race, I would have had the luxury of having 33 grand to put on somebody else.
It's great.
But it didn't. And so again, going back to the strategy, I thought 33 grand was the right number. And so with the extra that I had, yeah, I took a shot at maybe being able to include a second horse, and that just didn't work out. But thankfully, it didn't matter.
I don't think Jonathan is going to mind my saying this. I hope he doesn't. But you were exactly right with the 120. So he did at the end. I mean, these plays are getting published. I can't see how he could be upset with me for saying this. But he did at the end a 2x2 double. And it wasn't a pure Dutch. He weighted it a little bit. It's because he had a key horse in each race and a saver horse in each race. And it ended up coming saver, saver. So if it come Tarnawa essential quality, he might have had 130, maybe more. I forget exactly how it came down. You know, that would have been key. And if even one of the keys had won, I think it would have been very close to the 120. As it was saver, he got to the 90, 95, whatever it was. But your instinct was exactly right in terms of what to shoot for, as far as he was. And then, of course, you got to remember everybody else in behind you. And I'm sure there are some sob stories. I have not heard the sob story yet about, but you got to figure there's somebody all into modern games who only ends up getting their money back. You know, maybe the whole dynamic is different on Saturday, but it, as far as I'm concerned, anybody who thinks you overbet the pot, but because you won by 30,000 or whatever it is, they're not looking at it right.
Well, and look, I thought 3-1, and it sounds stupid, but I think it went off at 3.3-1. When you're betting 33 grand, 0.3 adds up to a lot.
Tons.
I mean, I've never thought this way before, and so I don't really think that way, but I was shocked to see the final total because I was assuming 5-2, 3-1, somewhere in that range. And so it's funny. This is intended to be self-deprecating. I'd say the worst job of handicapping I did on the weekend, and although you're making me feel better about it now, I felt like the worst job of handicapping I did was in picking the final target because I did, you know, I did clear the fence by quite a bit. But I just don't see how, and I'm not trying to be critical of Jonathan in any way. I am just not going to leave a putt short, period. I want the win. This is so top heavy. The reward is, it so justifies the risk, in my opinion. Believe me, I debated diluting that opinion a little bit with a big backup exact or whatever. And all I'm thinking is that every dollar I'm betting, I am foregoing $3.3 if I'm wrong in what I'm doing. And I just couldn't bear the idea of finishing with 110 and 125 winning this thing. And I had the ability to get it and I chose not to. So yes, I took a full swing. I am generally not a believer in savers. And yet Jonathan is sitting here with 95,000 and a second place finish for doing something that I would have never done. And so
for the second year in a row,
yes.
For the second year in a row. So, I mean, people, you know, they questioned the way the math worked last year. Well, what if you just took that money that you used in the double and bet it on Tarnow? Well, you know, I mean, and I think it was actually a very good friend, a very sharp guy who suggested that in Eric Bielik. And it just, you know, especially in the moment when you're moving that kind of money, it's like, you know, you don't know that the tote, I was expecting the tote price to correct on Tarnawa the whole time. I mean, she was 7-2 over there at her best number. So, you know, it was a shock to me that she was 9-2 on the tote, but that's a bit of a rabbit hole. But the idea is, and the way that he looks at it, which is the way that I would do it his way, not your way. Just, this is just a wagering personality thing. It's not about right or wrong, but the idea is what I can't live with is I'm completely right and I don't win. So that's the one that I want to make sure is correct. And I want to be kind of right and still be able to get something, if that makes sense.
It does. And it's a function of how you're looking at it. And from my perspective, the humility here is very genuine. I fully expect to finish this event with zero. You know, I'm sitting there at some point at the top of the leaderboard with 40 grand for a little while. I know that I got passed, but as you know already, I didn't really care. It didn't matter what other people were doing. So at the end of the day, it's a question of what your objective is. And for me, I was focused on winning this tournament and deluding myself. I just couldn't bear the thought of deluding myself to essentially leave the putt short. And so I took the big full swing. And yet, like I said, as I look at what JK did, I know what Marshall's strategy was last year. There's no way I'm going to try and poke holes in that strategy. I just think, you know, like I said at the very start of this, if that's your strategy, work backwards from that so that you can get to that. And it just wasn't in my strategy all along. The other thing I'm going to add about these doubles is this, and I'm not being critical of anybody when I say this, these doubles are a little dangerous. And what I mean by that is I sit there with my phone looking at the probables. And I knew an hour before the Classic that Essential Quality was going to be a meaningful favorite and that Nick Sko was going chilly on the board. He wasn't getting bet in the doubles. I was darn near certain that it was tournament players pounding Essential Quality in these doubles. You know, the dollars, I know on Breeders' Cup Day, it doesn't feel like you can affect the pools. That is not true in the daily double pool when you're betting massive daily doubles. And as I looked at the progression of how those probables were changing, it was crystal clear to me that the entire tournament field was off of Nick's Go and onto either Hot Rod Charlie or Essential Quality, which gave me actually even more confidence in sticking with Nick's Go because I could just tell no one was playing it.
It's interesting. That's certainly interesting. And you are right that the money in the double pool is much easier to move than in say the win pool. But in that contest with so much being bet, especially as years go on here, we need somebody better at math than me to figure out, you know, for example, without your bet on Nick's Go, what does he pay? You know, that's an easy thing to do if you know how to do the math. A conversation for another time, for sure. So here's what we're going to do, Matt. We're going to leave this as our very specific to the tournament strategy conversation. Things are going to quiet down here in a couple of weeks, and then we're going to bring you back for an hour, and we're just going to shoot the breeze, and it's going to be more like, who is Matt Miller? I haven't even made you give the basics. We'll make you do that anyway. Tell people how old you are, what you do for a living, and where you live.
50 years old. I am outside of Chicago in Northbrook, Illinois. I have got the best wife and two kids in college that a guy could ask for. I'm general counsel of a healthcare consulting firm in downtown Chicago, and I am a very recreational horse player. I grew up going to the track a bit with my grandpa Mike. I'm going to do my best not to tear up as I talk about him. He was the first person I really knew who found a way to tell everybody that he broke even every time he went to the track. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Just every time I broke about even.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, he was my start. I think that's probably true for a lot of horse players. I had some buddies in high school where we'd hit the harness races or the OTB. But as an adult, I have, you know, I started with these contests maybe 5 years ago, something like that. But I've otherwise just been a fan of going to Arlington Park in Arlington Heights, you know, 7-8 times a year, something like that. You know, it's just devastating beyond belief to see that that's gone. And, you know, those were my kids getting those jockey goggles, you know, when they were little, and, you know, all the other stuff that Arlington fans will remember.
Now you're going to make me cry.
It's tough. And so, you know, I'm expecting a question at some point about what's next. Yeah, of course, I'll go play the NHC, which is an event totally not made for me. I feel I am underadvantaged in that by quite a degree, being a B-minus handicapper. But given the bonus I'm going to be playing for, of course, I have to give it a shot. But with Arlington gone, you know, I told you this before, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I'm probably going to do a Saratoga trip this summer to kind of replace the Arlington experience. And after that, my next bets will be at the Breeders' Cup. I mean, that's kind of
hard,
really automatic of the year. So
it's hard to believe that that's all you're going to play between now and then. Incredible, really. And something to talk about, especially since you know, I'm surprised you don't tune us out. What do you get out of listening to us when you're not playing week in, week out?
I'm a fan. I like this stuff. I mean, it is a sport, and there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of drama, and some of it's on the track and some of it's off. You guys put out really entertaining content, and it's fun to listen to. And I hope I'm not sounding disrespectful. You've built quite an empire over there. I don't listen to every one of those podcasts. I can't. But
well, no one would have the time. Yeah, we never designed it to be that way, right? You're supposed to pick and choose.
But I pick the ones that feel the most entertaining to me. That can be a JK Plus One. That could be the Players Podcast. You know, whatever it is, based on what it looks like. But I enjoy following this stuff, and a little bit. I don't want to sound too nerdy. It feels like I'm doing homework for the end of the year. I mean, I just don't see how you can pick up a podcast in a daily racing form 2 weeks before the Breeders' Cup and catch up on what happened that year.
That's a great point. Especially with how Breeders' Cup centric we are, which, you know, Sean Borman makes fun of us for, and as do others. But, you know, it's not just because they're a client. It's like, to me, that's the interesting stuff, because the Breeders' Cup is such a great event. So it makes sense to me that if the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge was going to be your focus, that, you know, certainly around April or so, you should probably start paying attention to us every week.
Yeah. But look, besides in the money, I've got a number of friends that I've made over the years that have made a huge influence. You know, we talked about Brad, we talked about Joe, Dave Gutfriend I met a few years ago. And, you know, we didn't talk during the Breeders' Cup, but I've learned lessons from that guy over the years. And
he's brilliant.
You know, just keep your ears open. Nick Tamaro, I'll pick on him. The guy's fantastic to listen to. He's probably shocked I just picked his name out. We've never spoken, but you've got certain guests that come on your show that really speak to me in terms of giving me info that's good insight. And it, like I said, it just really helps to inform my own opinions. As you can tell, I'm very risk reward focused. I get made fun of in my everyday life for that. I am the only person, I assure you, walking around looking at the rental car line and trying to find strategic alternatives. Like, and I do this in my sleep. I mean, it's all about risk reward. It feels like everything I do. So it's only kind of fitting that something like this in the end, you know, brings that out, I guess.
We're going to get more into that when we have you back on a quiet week. But on this busy week, we're going to leave it here. Though I do want to chime in that you have made another big contribution to the In the Money Media Network, not just supporting us early on in various ways. I'm pretty sure you're the reason why we do the lifestyle shows. I think that was a bit of feedback from you, because whereas when, you know, JK reached out for me the first time, it was to ask a very down the rabbit hole tournament question. When you reached out to me for the first time, it was to ask me where to go go to eat at Santa Anita. I believe I told you Arroyo Chop House, where we ended up going for Brad Anderson's victory party back in 2019. So am I remembering correctly that you, the lifestyle shows basically your idea?
Spot on. Look, I'm going to go have a fantastic day at the races. I'm in a place that I don't know super well, and I'm with people that have been there before and gone to all the good restaurants. And so let me know where to go, where to stay, what to do. And yeah, those lifestyle shows have been great. Although at this point, I just don't see how I could ever eat anywhere other than the Pacific Coast Grill and Arroyo ever again in those two cities.
Too funny. That was a good meal. Steve Goldberg and the team at the Pacific Coast Grill do a fantastic job. Not sponsors, just I just basically can't stop going there. Anyway, Matt, thank you so much for your time today. We'll have you back for a longer visit soon, but I really wanted to get this out there and get your story out there, and you've been an absolute joy.
My pleasure. Thanks, Pete.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. Really, really fun to have guests on talking about the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. We thank JK. We thank Matt Miller for their contributions. That was really, really cool. How tickled I am now, 3 years in a row, to have an important in the money connected person win. And we've had the exact of the last 2 years. It's just ridiculous. So we'll thank one more time JK, Matt Miller. We'll thank our founding partners, 10 Strike Racing. Hey, speaking of Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, last year's winner, Marshall Graham. I'm sure he's happy to hand the baton over to Matt if it had to be somebody else. I don't know. Maybe he was rooting for JK to get his. But hey, there's always next year. And of course, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. So great at what they do. The Second Chances program, helping humans, helping horses. Please think of them. If you did well with some of the info we gave out here for Breeders' Cup, and I know a lot of you did, maybe give something back to them. We don't take tips. Give them straight to the horses. trfinc.org/players. Thanks, though, most of all, to all of you for listening, for watching, for supporting the shows throughout this Breeders' Cup week. Couldn't have done it without you. Your support means everything. Who knows? Maybe next year you'll be the in-the-money connected person that wins the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. Wouldn't that be nice? This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!